So tonight is the second talk in a four-talk series, an eight-class series, in which we're exploring sort of the foundations of the Buddhist principle. It's not even a Buddhist principle, it's just the principle of anatta, or selflessness. And I was on retreat with, I was leading a retreat in Portland this last weekend, and one of the people there, we were engaged in a group discussion on the meaning of life, and she said, well, she had been reflecting on that there was nobody home, and that life was then therefore meaningless, and she fell into despair. And so she says, how can there be any value to living when the ultimate foundation on which everything is built is selflessness? And the mind will create all kinds of problems from this word. It'll create the most difficult scenarios. And why would anybody want to continue sitting if those scenarios were true? I mean, they aren't very pretty. The mind doesn't picture itself, the absence of itself, very nicely. And yet the actual experience of that is vastly different than the fear projections that we conjure up. And so this series is just to give us a sense, a taste, a touch of the possibilities of that insight. It's not to startle us, certainly isn't meant to frighten us, and it certainly isn't meant to leave you with a feeling that you're doing something wrong because you're using meditation towards some sense of self-improvement. In fact, many people can use this principle of selflessness to throw themselves into despondency and depression, when the real heart of the teaching of this experientially is really love. So none of us in this room are doing anything wrong. If you're involved in therapy, well, doesn't this mean that therapy... No, it doesn't mean therapy is wrong. It doesn't mean that self-improvement is wrong. It doesn't mean anything. It just establishes a certain direction and tenet of practice for us to investigate, to look at, and let the life go as it goes, and let the insights that come through the practice change you. Not your decision to change because of the principle of anatta. You don't do it on a reflection or do it on an idea. You do it because you see. The seeing is what changes us. The insight is what changes us. The idea frightens us. Okay? And now many people have gone through trauma in their life and are very much involved in therapeutic interventions, which their story is an important aspect of their healing, working with their story. But tonight, because I have to, when I bring this topic up and talk about it, I have to take a kind of one-sided approach to get it home to you. But it doesn't mean in any way that I'm dismissing the other side. These two, in fact, walk lockstep with one another. The sense of being somebody and also the profound insights into being nobody, which in fact is my next talk. I'm going to talk about being somebody while you're busy seeing your nobody. So I really want you to hear that, because I give this talk and then I get on retreat countless notes. And so So I call this talk The Story and the Storyteller. And the principle on which the talk is based is that the story and the storyteller color are mutually dependent upon one another. And I deliberately pick kind of an objective third person, like a storyteller, rather than to keep talking about the sense of I and the sense, because I want you to get a sense of how the story and the storyteller are really the embodiment of who each of us think we are. And that without one, you can't have the other. You can't have a story without a storyteller, nor can you have a storyteller without a story. Those two arise together. And I want to start by telling a Buddhist, or just mentioning a Buddhist sutta that I've mentioned usually in terms of wise view, but some of you might not have heard that talk. So I just want to say, because it establishes the direction of the talk, and that's the story of the Buddha sitting in an audience of many of his monks, and in come a couple of ascetic monks, actually crawling on their knees. There is a cow ascetic and a dog ascetic. And it said that the cow ascetic had pasted a tail to his behind and crawled on all fours mooing. And the dog ascetic did whatever dogs do, and he curled up on by the feet of the Buddha in a dog kind of way. Immediately you get the sense of these very strange people from our point of view coming into this audience, and the Buddha not making fun of them whatsoever, because they must have been everywhere probably back then. Why to go to a zoo? Anyway, so these two animals, people, come in, and the one or the other of them, I think it was a dog ascetic, says to the Buddha, "What will happen if I continue to practice like a dog the rest of my life?" And the Buddha didn't want to answer that. But the man asked a second and a third time, and finally the Buddha agreed to answer. And he said, "The best that can happen to you, the best, is that you will be born the next life as a dog." At which time the guy got on his feet and said, "Ordain me as a monk." So we read that sutta, and it doesn't necessarily resonate too deeply with us. Some of us find ourselves practicing quite diligently as an ass, but not usually as the dog. And yet the Buddha is saying something here that I think is very important for all of us. And that is, he says, no matter how you're practicing, the embodiment of what you're practicing, the organism, the embodiment of what you're practicing, is the best you can hope to become from it. Now, we put ourselves in that picture. And we began to see that the message is that as long as my practice embodies me and all about me, and everything is centered around that concept of me, and my whole practice is a dialogue with me and an orientation and an accomplishment of mine, then mine is what we have left. Mine is the residue in the jar when everything has evaporated. In other words, when we die, that's what remains. But the Buddha's teaching is not about I, me, and mine as the residue, as the truth. It's about the investigation of what that is and coming to a different sense of how the practice can be utilized in relationship to the ideas of I, me, and mine. Which is vastly different than what we think it might be. Because the sense of I doesn't extinguish itself. It's not as if at some point, as we practice with the diligence of me, with me, that at some point it just extinguishes itself. We have to be working in conjunction with the principles and laws of selflessness from the beginning. That's why when we practice and sit down and we hold everything with a non-judgmental quality, when we don't evaluate, when we don't allow our thoughts to contaminate the awareness of what is seen, we are essentially devoiding what is seen from being I, me, or mine. We are seeing it for just what it is, without the label and fixation of me being engrossed within it, encased within it. Because the sense of self will use its very methods, meditation included, to justify its existence. And the further we effort our way with those methods, the more the birth of me takes place within that method. I was setting up a hospice program in Central Texas. And this was about 12 or so years ago, 13. And one of the towns in Central Texas, which our hospice included within its catchment area, was Killeen, Texas. And what happened one night was that somebody drove his car through the plate glass windows of a Luby restaurant, and in the midst of a crowded restaurant, and then took out his armed weapons and proceeded to shoot 23 people in that restaurant. And the next day, I went down there to sit and speak with a group of people who were hurting very badly from that incident, because Killeen, Texas is an army town. It's usually very transient but very small, and people know each other. And so everyone had someone who they had known. I just happened to be with a group of Rotarians, Rotary Club. And I was sitting around with the luncheon, and there were mostly business people, men and women, mostly men, sitting around the table. And this was the day after this incident occurred. And people were talking about how this incident proved the need to have firearms, which, of course, was exactly the opposite conclusion I had reached. But what I saw was that the need for control, the need to control, the need for security, when you're afraid, when life has been shaken, goes and embellishes further control. It never comes to the conclusion of the relinquishment of control. It never comes to willfully letting something go. It's, I have to add more to this situation to become more secure. And as we as a country, if I can just show a slight parallel here, as we as a country become more fearful, we become more patriotic within that fear. We don't test that maybe there's some way that we can look at the world in terms of human beings. We gather around the collective, the gathering collective of Americans, and pull in our sense of patriotism, which is a shield from the fear. So what does this have to do with the talk tonight? As we begin to meditate and see ourselves, our perspective shifts. We become fearful. We become challenged. We become a little confused. Our perceptions don't add up to what we have always thought or held them to be. That's an experience. If you've been on a retreat, you can have this experience of your perceptions a little bit drug-like. If we go back a few decades to the 60s. But you're not on a drug. And there's a kind of way that can be very unsettling. And what mostly occurs from that sense of unsettledness is a pulling back and a solidification of me, not an exploration of the me. It's as if when we're attacked, we pull back into what we best know, what is best known. And any fear we take is an attack. And yet the whole meditation process is laced with just the principles of not knowing. I mean, that's what ultimately, you might say, the state of freedom accesses. It's a mind that doesn't rest in assurance, in certainty. And if we keep pulling back every time we've become slightly ajar, which can happen not necessarily on retreat, but on your daily practice. Have you noticed that after you practice, suddenly you might find yourself at the refrigerator eating chocolate or some way to get to get the whole thing grounded back to what is known, to reestablish you. Turning on the radio. Okay, let me get back here. Right? So the more insecure we become, the more we try to tighten the reins around I, me, and mine. We fall back into that assumption. We assert that assumption again and again. I need to try harder. You know, we do something which allows me to regain my footing. So watch this tendency in your practice, and not just all of our practices. Oftentimes, striving itself in practice, that ambitious effort, is a result that there's some shaking going on there. And the effort is really the effort to get out of that shakiness. But the last thing it wants to do is to look at the shakiness itself, the fear itself. That's which is the driving force of the sense of me. Because we generate our story, so I'm going to bring in this metaphor now. We generate our story of who we are to hold ourselves from slipping with uncertainty. We rest with the story, our history, our struggle with history. And we project that history into the future. And the sense of me embellishes that as a kind of tunnel in which I can walk safely through life, from past through present. Present doesn't mean anything, except that it laces the present. It's what laces the future with the past. It's an impoverished presence, if it exists at all. And so we hold on to the story as a way to secure ourselves. And then we sit down in meditation and we work on our story. And we carry this story into the very practice that is supposed to lead to the unknowing uncertainty of who we are. We use it to rehearse the certainty, to reestablish the certainty. And everything that comes up has to do with me. The content is so full, and we just, not all the time, but how much of the time do we just spend thinking in our meditation? The story is so... 20 minutes, perhaps, of the 30 we sit? Is that fair? And the storyteller finds happiness and reward within that story. It's where the storyteller seeks its happiness because it knows as it finds and defines its story, it becomes defined as well. It becomes clearer. Its outline becomes better known. And so the whole thing is played laterally, not vertically, in time. Past, present, future. God, when is this practice going to be? When's the bell going to be? When's the half hour? How long am I going to have to be with my pain of loneliness? See, the whole thing is played out laterally on the stage. That's the story. That's the story. That's where we're comfortably defined. And I say this very gently, but that's where the dog and ascetic, the dog and the cow move most easily. Now, see, I don't want you to start... I have to say it this way, and I have to say it this... Because we have to... The Buddha said his teaching had one and only one taste, and that's the taste of freedom. So I have to play out this side pretty absolutely so that we get a taste of what freedom is. And freedom really doesn't reside within our story. It just won't. In fact, that's the only problem we have. That's it. There is not another one. And you might say that the whole of spiritual practice, when it's done with sincerity, is to change the lateral dimension to a vertical one. The horizontal to a vertical. And we keep hoping that we can find our contentment within the story. We just haven't done enough in the story to find that contentment. So our hope is that the story that we tell ourselves, the storyteller, will tell a better fable that will come out with a better ending. And yet somehow the story is never fulfilled on that lateral, horizontal dimension because there's always more to do. Whenever we have arrived at whatever we think is the happy ending, by evaluation and comparison, we see we're nowhere yet. And off we go again to fill in the blanks, the pages, and to write the complete, perfect fable. And where is this being written? This is where it's interesting, you see. It's being written, the story is written entirely within our imagination. That's what a story is. That's what a storyteller does. It fabricates. Totally abstract. Totally unreal. Totally within the content of thought. And so an abstract entity trying to generate the perfect light through an abstract medium, well, I think there's going to be some failure there. Because reality waits. And the abstract, at some point, is going to hit the juncture of reality. It's going to come down. It's going to fall. It's going to So this is a talk of hope, not despair. This is not despair. Despair is that all you've got is your story, now go out and live it. That's despair. Oh, God, that's real despair. Suppose that was all it was. Suppose this is it. We have a right to be depressed. And as we play out, trying to generate more and more story towards some sense of completeness, the sense of incompleteness becomes part of the story. This is really interesting. We begin then to assume the attitude of incompleteness as a statement of self, as a statement of who I am in my storytelling. I'm inadequate, I'm unworthy. The reality of that cannot be found except in your story. It has no governance. It has no validity. It has no truth. But because even a bad definition is better than no definition, we'll play out the bad one. So we have a bad definition. That's okay. We'll hang our head a little low, our shoulders will become a little rounded, we'll stoop a little, and we'll fit the image of what the story needs to have as a self. I worked in my social work field placement, I was placed, this was in Ohio, I was placed in a maximum security prison with teenagers who were not nice guys. They were like rapists and murderers and armed robbery and just, but they're all teenagers. They're like 13, 14, 15. One of the 13-year-olds had killed both his parents. I mean, it's just, you know, the stories were just. So I worked with one person in particular, and we worked and we worked. I mean, it was a 9-month field placement, and I saw him, I don't know how many times a week for the period of time, and there was some sincerity there. There was some real feeling of progress, and at that point we were using in the Dharma, so I wasn't using meditation, we were using transactional analysis, which to help him move through his life and to see what he wanted and that sort of thing. So then I gave him a very strong recommendation, which was taken at heart when his name came up for being paroled. And I said, yes, you know, I really have worked with him. I really think, and I did. I think he was very sincere. So he goes out and goes back to the same area in which he had grown up, and 3 months later, he shoots a person in the head. You see, his story was so captivating that the little bit of time, I think he had spent 2 or maybe 3 years in this maximum security, couldn't withstand, and I think he was sincere. He was really trying to change, but it wasn't enough for him when he went back into the same population that brought forth the same old conditioning again. He fell back in the same patterns. So you might ask yourself, how long have you been sitting? Give yourself a break here. You know, you might have 40 or 50 years of conditioned reference of I, me, mine, this and that, and the struggle, inward struggle, and the patterns that keep forcing themselves in there. And maybe 3 or 4 or 5 years of sitting, we very easily fall back into those old patterns again. This is a lifetime practice. This is a lifetime. How could it not be? And the story waits to be embellished. It is, you just, it just is extraordinarily humbling for me when I see the power of my story.
Okay.
And that, I think the bowing of the head is a good act. And humility. Because anything, any vanity or arrogance is just more story. And the only natural thing you can do when you see its power is to bow your head. Okay. Well, okay. Releasing ourselves. Okay. There, and then there's the innocence of heart that can actually hold the story rather than to follow it. We should all learn that. At the end of sittings, as we gently bow to one another, we're not bowing in some kind of form. We're bowing in humility. And also how we need each other as reminders that our story is not the whole story. And so our story can actually become so embedded within our psyche that we start playing out its themes through our perceptions, through our paranoia, through our projections. It's as if we constantly replay out the same themes because the patterns have been so ensconced in us that we just assume those patterns and play them out and play them out and play them out. And we can see how enormously conditioned those patterns are when the pain gets into a reaction with your spouse or loved one or whoever, and it's just this animal almost comes out, this other creature seems to externalize itself, and then after it blows itself out somehow, first it feeds on the reactivity. And then you go, what was that? Who was that? Have you ever had that? Like, what was that? My God, what was that? That's the story. And the story, that's the story. And the storyteller merging. That's the storyteller forgetting he's telling a story. That's exactly what that is. Storyteller at one point knew what we want to do is go back and know we're telling a story. That's what we want to do. It's when we start thinking that the whole thing has to be played out in some way. And the storyteller solves his problems by reshuffling content. That's what the storyteller does. I have a problem. The storyteller never looks internally to see what is the basis of a problem, the cause of the genuine root cause of the problem. He or she stays externalized or internalized and blames himself. That's a big one. It's me. I'm the one that's at fault. It's the storyteller who's at fault for having this. And so we just keep trying to judge the content of the story around, making the storyteller somehow better by adding some of this. And but there's one hope, and that's pain. Yeah, yep, that's it. Because it doesn't work. You see? That's the hope. That's the only way out. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. I mean, if we slow down just a little and perceive ourselves just, I mean, just, we're not talking about heavy perception here. We're talking about just a glance. We notice that it isn't working. And then we think, okay, what do I do now? It's not working. If we're that sincere and that honest, we find our way into some sort of introspective practice that allows us to come to the root causes of the pain rather than to constantly play through the content. But the storyteller doesn't give up easily. The storyteller has two big tools for his story. Big tools. These are real, you know, every art, the art of storytelling has these tools. And that's fear and desire. Now, fear and desire are like the craft of the storyteller. And then think about it for a minute. Reality is occurring, and a desire happens over reality, which is a supposition of how reality should be, which is my desire, and then there's how reality really is, which is the truth of the situation. And my story, my fabrication, goes with the desire. This is how I want this story, the now, to evolve into the then. And I also say, and I'm also afraid that now may evolve into some tragic thing, which is fear. But it's all another story. Do you see that? We just tell ourselves more subtle stories. The story of how what I'll be like when I'm enlightened. Anyone have any questions? So those are the tools of a good storyteller. A good storyteller doesn't want to come back to plumb line. Because when we're at rest, we ain't there. When we're at rest, which is what the storyteller fears the most, it needs to tell another story to get itself defined. So I'm sitting here, it's too cool in this room. 5 minutes later, I don't know how this temperature works. It's too hot. But it does work like that in this room. And you can see, you go, it's too hot. Now it's too cold. It's too hot. And in the course of a 45-minute sitting, about 9 times I felt one way or the other on that. Each time, within the resistance of having my story be told, then there's a storyteller. I'm defined. I'm the person who's too warm. I'm the person who's having trouble with my knee. I'm the person who is annoyed with the person next to me. These are all stories. And as soon as we tell a story, you know, there's empowerment of the storyteller. There's a sense of definition. And what we're loath to do is to be without a story, without a fable, without a theme, without a sense of this is who I am and I bring it here and this is what I need to work on. Oh, God. Ooh. I'm just making a little bit of fun now, all right? I know that the story is, some stories are extraordinarily difficult to have any transparency with. And I don't at all want to make it be insensitive to some of the torturous history that some of us have been through. and to play out the themes of those stories, and to begin to come to that sense of, okay, well, now I can let it go. I can release some of this, is really the gentle process of therapy or any healing that needs to be done. And few of us, if we've had a torturous story, can just throw those, just go into the middle of that pain. We don't seem to be able to do that. So timing is very much a part of the equation of being able to let go of your story. And as we begin to practice, you can see the story changing a little bit. From emphasis on content, the rearranging, the reshuffling, the regrouping of content and things in our life, and he did this, and I'm going to say that to him, and the history of my parents, I've got this, all of that, as we become quieter, it changes to what we call processes of mind, where we actually see not the story, but emotion, physical sensation, thoughts, sounds, smells, what exactly the story is made up of, the ingredients, the writing material. And when you see a thought, when we are able to hear our thought, that's a tremendous space. We're giving this story now tremendous space. And no longer are we puppets to it. And even though we're hearing our thoughts, usually there's a subtler story back there who's the watcher of the hearer of those thoughts. And so the story continues to play itself out in subtle ways. But the process is irreversible. Once we've seen it, okay, now you've heard your thought. Well, I know I'm thinking. That's vastly different than being swept up within the thinking, being directed by the thinking. And so we begin in earnest to look at the storyteller, which is the root cause, not the content of the story. Not the justification of the story, not the defense of the story, or the rationalization of the story, or the denial of the story. Because all of those will eventually crash into reality. You think you're not going to die? You don't think you're going to get old? You don't think you're going to get sick? You don't think your loved one's going to die? It has to crash. In fact, it has to crash. And when you see your story is a fable because it's going to crash, that proves it's just been a story. Okay, now, so this is it. I've got to get this, let this go, or I'm going to crash with it. You see, when there's a story, there's you who's going to crash right along with the story when it crashes into reality. But if we let go of the story, there's no crash. That's what freedom is. Who would we be without a story? That's the homework, to ask yourself in the middle of your themes, of your fables, of this week's working. Who would I be? Just ask yourself that. Don't make it any more than just that simple. Who would I be without this story? What would I be? Not who. What would I be without this story? What would I be without MD in front of my name? Or PhD, or MSW, or Joe, Jim, Jack, Jill. Who would I be without all of that? Who would I be? What would I be? And the story then collapses into silence, into the mystery, which is anatta, but is not the desert, absent, abeyant, lack and lonely me. It's the fullness of presence, the richness of being, the aliveness of vitality. How can we deny that? How could we ever question that? It's just a story. Reality's here anyway. What do we think we're going to do to give up the story? You don't give up anything. You give up a fiction. You give up a fantasy. You give up air. You give up nothing. It's not like all of a sudden, I don't exist. You just see what existence is. That's all. And it's done gently. It's done from the heart. It's done from love. Because that's where the final chapter ends. That's the final period. That's the resting place. That's the book is closed, finished. Okay. Love. And now you can put it back on the shelf. And what's done is done. And so the story's finished. And I don't have to keep going down that same road time and time again, bumping my head into the same caverns, into the same stalactites and stalagmites and rough edges. And I don't have to keep doing that. That's just all story collision. I don't have to do that anymore. I don't have to go that way anymore. Just be quiet. Just want to be quiet. Don't you just want to be quiet? Let us sit for a minute or two.